This is a cycling podcast at the 2025 Vuelta a España, proudly supported by Lloyds. All this week we've been covering the world's best riders competing in two major races, the Vuelta, the third Grand Tour of the summer of course, and the Lloyds Tour of Britain as it's made its way from the east of England across to Wales. It's a race that marks the end of Geraint Thomas's glorious career, during which he's won the Tour de France for Team Sky and Olympic and world titles for Great Britain. In fact, at the very beginning of his career, he rode Britain's national tour for the Great Britain team, and he's back on the road at the Lloyds Tour of Britain this week, which we're covering with daily episodes. Lloyds is supporting British cycling from the very top to the sports grassroots, which includes title sponsorship of the Lloyds Tour of Britain races for both men and women, and the Great Britain national team. Through its partnership with British Cycling, Lloyds wants to inspire the next generation of national heroes. There's a team of young British riders representing Great Britain this week in the Lloyds Tour of Britain, and perhaps there's been a superstar of the future out on the roadside watching the race who will be inspired by the riders that they've seen. The Cycling Podcast has all the racing covered thanks to sponsorship from Lloyds. Now though, it's over to Daniel in Spain. Lloyds, there at every stage.
You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at the 2025 Vuelta a España, celebrating 10 years of the Cycling Podcast on the ground every day at the Grand Tours.
Brian, Nygaard, buenas tardes. The only Dane in my vicinity tonight after I was surrounded last night. But Brian, how are you?
Yeah, I'm good, Daniel. Thank you. Buenas tardes.
Excellent. Where are you, Brian, in fact?
Daniel, I am still at home in Liguria. I am leaving for California in less than a week, counting the days.
Splendid, splendid.
I'm counting sugar values in grapes at the moment. I have FOMO. Seeing other vineyards being picked before mine, so yeah, it's always that time of year for me.
The bunches are, we've noticed this over the last couple of weeks when we've been running in the morning. Quite often we're running in vineyards. We've been noticing the bunches getting heavier and heavier by the day, Brian.
Yeah.
Ready to be picked here as well. Brian, I should have been able to describe for you and the listeners the wonderful view from the top of La Farapona towards, which direction was I looking? Towards the Peña Ubiña anyway, one of the biggest mountains in the Cordillera Cantabrica, which is the mountain range we were in today. I did have a fantastic view of that when I set up to record tonight, but then the Movistar Tower was taken down, Brian. The Movistar Tower, which gives us network coverage at the finishes of, particularly when we're on top of mountains, as we were today on La Farapona. So instead, I have decamped to our car. It might sound a bit sort of car-y today, the acoustics, and that is why. Outside the window, you might also be able to hear the sort of droves of cyclists, the freewheels of all the cyclists heading down the mountain. Massive crowds today, and they are all making their way home. But Brian, we saw a fantastic stage. We saw, talking Movistar, last time I was up here in 2020, Brian, a Movistar rider, his name was Marc Soler, came very close to winning up here, and he was a plucky, unlucky, maybe loser to David Gaudu. Well, he got redemption today, didn't he? Marc Soler, just to spoiler the stage result already.
He certainly did. Yeah, it was a fantastic stage. And this Vuelta just, who could have predicted? I mean, one thing is predicting Marc Soler going after specifically this stage. We even spoke about it yesterday. But UAE winning seven. There's so many layers to this and so much involuntary irony. I guess we'll be talking about that later. Yeah, looking forward to getting my teeth into this one.
We will. We will be getting our fangs deep into this one. As unfortunately has become customary over the last few days, in our recap of what was happening in the morning at the start of today's stage, we're mainly going to be talking about events off the bike. I don't think we need to sort of justify it anymore. We've done that already, why we're talking about this issue. But I am going to tell you what happened overnight and this morning in terms of what has become the big story, certainly off the bikes over the last few days, really, or some would say since the team time trial in Catalunya, well over a week ago. I am, of course, talking about the pro-Palestine protests. We had 12 arrests for the events of yesterday, the race being obstructed at the bottom of the Angliru. At least one of the individuals arrested was from a group called the Anticapitalistes Asturias group. So an anti-capitalist group from Asturias. That's the region we're in today. Israel Premier Tech we're not going to sign on today. In case I haven't already mentioned that over the last few days, they do not, or that since the incident in the team time trial, they have not been signing on in the morning, or they've not been presented before the crowd, before the stages. Significantly, very significant. The Spanish Minister of Foreign Affairs, European Union Cooperation, José Manuel Álvarez, said in a radio interview that Israel Premier Tech, in his opinion, should go home because, in his words, we need to send a message that we can only have relations with other countries based on mutual respect of human rights. That's his quote. There was communication, a message we, I suppose, didn't expect, because we're not accustomed to heads of state involving themselves in matters at the Vuelta a España. But the Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, tweeted his support for Israel Premier Tech overnight. He said, great job to Silvan and Israel cycling team. Interestingly, he called them Israel cycling team. We know they're not a national team. And I do wonder sometimes how much confusion there has been over that, particularly on the part of people commenting, well, who are not sort of cycling specialists. Anyway, he said, great job to Silvan and Israel cycling team for not giving in to hate and intimidation. You make Israel proud. Incidentally, Silvan Adams himself, that is boss of Israel Premier Tech, gave an interview to, I think they called it Israel Sports Channel, I think it was yesterday, decrying what had happened in Bilbao a few days ago and in the Basque country, generally, which he called a bastion of extreme left-wing activism and protests. He said, we won't give in to terrorists. Silvan Adams, incidentally, was out on his bike this morning yet again, so no comments to the press. He hasn't been speaking to the press here at the Vuelta a España. And finally, I should also mention that Israel Premier Tech were racing in a changed strip today, which no longer bore the name Israel, the word Israel. They had wanted to change their kit a few days ago, but apparently it wasn't quite ready for the riders here. Oh, I should also mention that I just got confirmation this morning that Israel Premier Tech have no intention of removing the name Israel from their team name, either in Spain or anywhere else permanently. So Brian, that was that. Should we move on to
El Jamonómetro de Michele Peracci?
Brian, today's Jamonometro. How many hams, please?
Do we work with halves here, Daniel? Is there a precedence for that?
I don't know. Brian, incidentally, last night we stayed in Oviedo, and there's a bar in Oviedo called Jamon Jamon, which is where all of the sort of movida in Oviedo seems to emanate from. Well, certainly this sort of student nightlife, it seems, and it was absolutely rammed last night.
It's also a name, the title of a very important film of Pedro Almodovar.
Brian, we can have fractions. We talked the other day about having, I think, 3.8 hams, sort of 8 slices in a bocadillo. Oh. You can do whatever you want.
Okay, because, as we all know, the real jamón ibérico should be cut by hand or sliced by hand anyways. So I will slice off 3.7. Jamón 0.7.
A little bit parsimonious from El Barón this evening. I thought you might give it more than that. Anyway, we won't debate it too much. Maybe we'll debate it later in the episode. As always, though, we shall get to the hard facts of what occurred today. We should remind you that before today's 14th stage, Jonas Vingegaard led the Vuelta a España by 46 seconds from João Almeida and 2 minutes and 18 seconds from Tom Pidcock. On the menu today were a third cat climb, a first cat climb, and a first cat climb. It was the summit finish. Ivan Cortina of Movistar was on home roads before the start today. He talks about having been on La Farapona in 2011 as a spectator, as a very young spectator. Of course, in that Vuelta, it was the big battle between Cobo and Froome. Cobo, who won the Vuelta a España, well, he was crowned the winner at the time, was subsequently stripped of that title due to doping. He was the homeboy, incidentally, yesterday at Cabezón de la Sal. I saw Manolo Saiz, formerly of Once, the manager of Once, bemoaning the fact there'd been no tribute to Cobo yesterday morning at Cabezón de la Sal. Manolo, I think I think, son, you may have lost touch with reality. Anyway, Ryan Taramai was the winner that day in 2011 on La Farapona. Also worth noting, today was Jack Haig, our good friend Jack Haig's birthday. And Sergio Higuita of Astana was a DNS this morning. In the opening skirmishes, Bahrain victorious were the most active team, I would say, particularly Finley Pickering, he was trying to get away. And a sizable group, eventually did get away. In it, some notable names: Mikel Bjerg, Marc Soler, Victor Campenaerts, Andrea Bajoli, Carlos Verona, Cepeda of Movistar, Nico Dentz, Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe, Tim van Dijk. I'm going to say there were four Decathlon riders, including Almirai. James Shaw was also there for EF Education First. Pickering did make it into the break. Kevin Vermaak was also there for Picnic Post NL. And a couple of others. Asparen of Q36.5 and Lem Reiser of Picnic Post NL would also eventually make it across. Incidentally, Campenaerts briefly lost touch when he had a mechanical, but got back on partly thanks to a neutral service bike he was seen riding for a few kilometres. Bruno Almirai was going to exceed 2,000 kilometres off the front of races for this year, and thanks to that breakaway today, and he was also the best placed rider overall at just 12 minutes down. La Cima de Tenebreo was the first climb of the day. Marc Soler was the first over the top. Mikel Bjerg had been pulling hard for them in that lead group. And as the group headed towards the bottom of the first of the two first cat climbs, the San Lorenzo, the gap was over 6 minutes. So a very sizable gap. Visma were controlling the peloton on the San Lorenzo. The group at the front was splitting after Decathlon, with their four riders, started to force the pace. In the main peloton, UAE had started to pull, although Red Bull was sort of waiting in the wings, just on their shoulder. And there were some early casualties among the GC, sort of GC riders, Egan Bernal and Santiago Buitrago, getting popped at about 4 or 5 kilometres. I think it was about 5 kilometres from the top. Ciccone was also dropped on the San Lorenzo. We had UAE mainly setting the pace, as I've already said. Ayuso was putting in a sterling turn today. He pulled for a long time on San Lorenzo and down the other side. I should say that James Shaw was the first rider over the San Lorenzo. He tried to go solo, didn't get too far. That had been about a 10 or 11 man group over the top of the San Lorenzo in the breakaway, with the likes of Soler, Verona, Garofoli, Almirai. He had two teammates, Decathlon teammates. Pickering was there as well. On the other side of the San Lorenzo descent, we would eventually get Stauner, Mittet and Soler going away on their own. We saw various satellite riders coming back at this point. Mikel Bjerg came back and he was able to, well, later on at the bottom of La Farapona, he was able to do some sterling work. Nico Dens had also come back and he'd been on the front for Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe. Finally, Brian, at the bottom of La Farapona, Marc Soler went solo. He was able to bid farewell to Johannes Stauner Mittet, and that would be the last company that Marc Soler had, because he would solo to victory. Meanwhile, Brian, in the GC group, tell us what was happening.
First of all, UAE were pulling. Initially, they were pulling with the riders who were left there. Then Mikel Bjerg came back from having been in the breakaway and did a very valiant effort there. After that, Groschartner took over, as we've seen before. He's sort of growing stronger and stronger in this welter. At this point, when they were 12 men in the favorites group, Groschartner was pulling. Vingegaard at this point had Kuss and Tollet up front. When they had 6 kilometers to go, the gap was around 2.5 minutes. So when Jay Vine was done, it was, like I said, Groschartner. With 3 kilometers to go, we saw there was quite a bit of a headwind on that part of the climb, but the tempo did go up significantly when Pellizzari took over, and it seemed like there would be a bit of an attack coming from Hindley, and that was certainly the case, and that was sort of what opened it up in the favorite group. And Hindley went away with Vingegaard and Almeida immediately on his wheel. And as they moved away, the three of them, Soler was obviously winning the stage. They couldn't really do anything. No one could really drop anyone other than Vingegaard edging his wheel in front of Almeida at basically at the finish line. So he took the bonus seconds, meaning they gained what must have been just 2 seconds, really.
Indeed, Brian, the two strongest riders in this Vuelta a España, Vingegaard and Almeida, finishing together, but Vingegaard just getting his nose ahead of Almeida to take the extra bonus seconds. We'll give you the GC in just a moment. Jai Hindley was detached, had been detached in the last couple of hundred metres, having been with those two after Pellizzari had set him up. A little bit further back, so, well, I'll give you the results. It was Vingegaard and Almeida, 39 seconds down. Hindley, 43 seconds. Gao next, 48 seconds. Pellizzari in a little group at 53 seconds with Riccitello. Pidcock and Kuss, then Finley Pickering, another survivor from the breakaway. A great ride by him again today. 125 down. And, well, if we look for names that we considered GC riders maybe a couple of days ago, we have to go well down the results. And really, I would suggest that with sort of Sepp Kuss, maybe you could even say Tom Pidcock, that kind of concludes the GC battle. Increasingly seems as though that's where it kind of ends. So at that point, I am going to skip forward to give you the GC. Jonas Vingegaard has extended his lead over Joao Almeida by 2 seconds, the grand total of 2 seconds. He now leads by 48 seconds. Tom Pidcock is 2:38 down. Jai Hindley continues to sort of inch closer to Pidcock. He's 3 minutes 10 behind Vingegaard. Then we've got Felix Gau, 3:30. Pellizzari, 4:21. And Riccitello, 4:53, then Kuss 5:46. Incidentally, the next name, ninth on general classification, is still Torsten Tryon, who is 6 minutes and 33 seconds down. In the points competition, no real change there, although Vingegaard has picked up some points today. Pedersen still leads convincingly, and Jay Vine is still in the mountains jersey, although Jonas Vingegaard is getting closer. Vine now has 46 points, Vingegaard 39. Pellizzari had another good day, but Riccitello is staying very close to him. Still just 32 seconds off Pellizzari's white jersey. Brian, I suggest, given that the day belonged to UAE and it was their seventh extraordinary number, extraordinary feat, seventh stage win today, I suggest we hear from two UAE riders. Let's hear first from, not the stage winner, Marc Soler, but Joao Almeida. And then we are going to hear from a rider many would consider behind Marc Soler to be the man of the match today. That's your countryman, Mikel Pierre.
I mean, the headwind was stronger than expected, so we couldn't do much, but we tried. So, yeah, the team was amazing again.
Vine, Groschottner, Berg, Mikel Berg in particular did a massive pull after dropping back.
Yeah, everybody was crazy today. We did a perfect job. And chapeau to Mark for the stage win. He deserved it.
And a little bit of bonus seconds. Jonas just got the sprint.
Yeah, he's one of the strongest riders in the world. So.
Yeah, the first climb I squeezed it a bit on the steep section, and yeah, I think you could feel the breakaway was also a bit tired after the break formation in the start, and yeah, I just said to Mark that he had to keep the victory in mind, and I think he was always, you know, he would stop if the car asked him to, and yeah, luckily we were never in a situation where Joao was really under pressure. Yeah, he fully deserved it, you know, it's not like a bad tactic, you know. We have him in the front, and if Joao is, as I said, if he would be under pressure, we could always call him back. So, and from my understanding on the radio, Joao was the guy pushing the pace in the final climb. He was never in pending mode.
To those who say that, well, seven wins, amazing, but Joao needs all the help. He needs all the resources. that you can give him and that you guys should be getting in breaks, what do you say?
I think the reason why we stayed in the break was to have me as a satellite rider to push it up in the valley. And I did what I could. And after me, Felix and Jay did an amazing job. And I think really set up Joao. In the end, the climb was a lot of headwind, and I think it was not easy to make the difference in the GC group. And from my understanding, I didn't watch the race, obviously, but he looked good, and he did a podium.
Just generally speaking, you guys continue to go for stage wins, continue to get them, but to those who say you should just all be around Joao.
Yeah, I simply don't agree. I think for a guy like me, I would never have passed the second last climb in the GC group, so would make no sense for me to stay with him all day, because I wouldn't be able to stay with him in the last valley. So I don't know, people are entitled to have opinions that I should stay with him in the start, but I would never have passed the second last climb. It's like this.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind me to tell you that this episode is sponsored by Indeed. If you're in charge of recruitment for your company, whether it's a small, a medium, or a large-sized company, Indeed is all you need. You can stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites, because Indeed sponsored jobs will help you stand out from the crowd and hire more quickly. With sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want to interview more quickly. And it's important to fill a vacancy as quickly as you can, because all the while it's left unfilled, other team members are working harder to compensate. But you don't just want to fill the role with anybody, you want to identify the best possible candidates. And that's where sponsored jobs from Indeed really makes a huge difference. According to Indeed's data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applicants than non-sponsored jobs. Plus, with Indeed sponsored jobs, there are no monthly subscriptions, no long-term contracts, you only pay for results. And it's quick too. In the minute or so I've been talking to you, around 23 hires have been made on Indeed, and that's according to Indeed's data. There's no need to wait any longer. Speed up your hiring process right now with Indeed. Listeners to the Cycling Podcast will get a £100 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at indeed.com/cycle. Just go to indeed.com/cycle right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on the Cycling Podcast. Indeed.com/cycle. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring. Indeed is all you need.
Another masterclass from UAE. If you consider, if you believe that their main goal, their only goal, I'm not going to say only goal, their main goal, is to keep accumulating these stage victories. We've speculated a lot about this over the last few days. We've talked about their use of their extensive resources, and we heard Michael Bjerg telling me, well, certainly justifying the tactical choices they made today, and it all sort of worked out in the end, because Joao Almeida, well, he put pressure on Vingegaard again, didn't he? And he certainly didn't look at any point as though he was lacking teammates, although I should mention that at 7.5 kilometers to go, I think it was, he stretched out his hand. It looked as though he was asking a Q36.5 Soigneur for a bottle. And that was also presumably because at that point, I think Groschartner may still have been with him at that point, but he certainly wasn't surrounded by teammates. And I would suggest that if they had not sent Soler in the breakaway, maybe Bjerg wouldn't have been there. But he may well at that point have had a couple more teammates to give him things like bottles and food if he'd needed them.
I think there's a couple of perspectives that are relevant here. You know, it's an extraordinary thing to win seven stages. I mean, that's, you know, now this is the 80th stage, 80th win of the season, which is, you know, bonkers and everything. They couldn't have imagined that Vingegaard at this point of the Vuelta, you know, after stage 14, would only have had a lead of 48 seconds. None of us would have imagined that. So if it's very theoretical or academic, hypothetical, what have you, to say that, or could they have had put all those efforts into a collective battleground of trying to go up against Vingegaard? Because how could they have known? You know, especially initially when we saw Vingegaard, it looked prudent of him to save his resources And obviously for the team, for Jumbo-Visma, not to ride the first part of the Vuelta as they did in the Tour. I mean, that wouldn't have made any sense. When you and I did the preview, at least I talked about that some of the favorites wanted to save the energy for the beginning of the Vuelta, the middle week being the hardest potentially, and all of that. So it's all hypothetical, but you can't help still now to think, what if, at least imagine if Ayuso would have been a threat in the GC. They would have had two amazing cards to play, and they could have had a fighting chance against Vingegaard.
It was only a few days ago, Brian, that Marc Soler was still only 3 minutes down on general classification. In another, well, the whole stage would have been completely different today if Marc Soler had still been in general classification.
It wouldn't have kept Vingegaard awake at night, though, having Soler up there in the GC, I think.
I don't know. I think we've all had nightmares about Marc Soler at some point in our lives.
Yeah, but not necessarily about winning the Vuelta ahead of Vingegaard.
I mean, I had one with about 5 kilometres. I had a Marc Soler nightmare with about 5 kilometres to go in today's stage because I imagined the order going from the UAE team car to Marc Soler to sit up because João Almeida needed him in that roaring. I have to tell you that I know probably the commentators in the various countries where the listeners were watching the race, they were talking about the headwind, but it was a roaring headwind and it was a roaring tailwind on the San Lorenzo. Yeah. So again, we talked yesterday about João Almeida's inability, among his many, many virtues and incredible virtues that he's displaying at this Vuelta a España, his inability to create separation. Obviously, had he been able to get away from Vingegaard, but found himself flapping around in that headwind, maybe that would have been a situation where Soler would have got the call.
For all of us who haven't raced, I mean, but we've definitely seen it happen many times when there is a very significant headwind on a climb, there's only so many things you can do, even if the climb is hard and even if it is on a stage like today with more than 4,000 meters of climbing, it really makes a hell of a difference if there is a headwind, if you want to do something. Regardless of all the hypothetical questions, there's still hard stages remaining in this Vuelta, and it certainly doesn't look as if Vingegaard has. There was part of me speculating, oh well, after the Angliru stage, he's going to come back today and show that yesterday was just a day where he wasn't at his best, you know, and then he will bounce back and everything. But certainly that wasn't the case. Kuss is looking increasingly better. Jorgensen is looking like he's not exactly, well, he's certainly not the strongest of those two helpers around Vingegaard. And I'm hearing more and more people, and I don't know what your take is on that, you know, looking forward. Now, do you think that Almeida is the better of the two on that 27-kilometer time trial? You know, how close do you think that's going to be, if it's going to be down to that?
I think it could be very close. I would say they're at pretty much at parity in terms of their, I mean, I haven't looked up the head-to-head results in time trials. It's always very difficult to judge that because you don't know what people's various motivations were. Often you can't remember what people's motivations were.
There's certainly overall, I mean, if you just take as an indicator the team time trial, there's certainly in a better setup at the moment, one could say, right? Also going back to the Tour, it looks like they're in a better state, technically at least at this point. And then if you look at the recovery, if you look at the way Almeida went into this Vuelta, there's a point to be made that he's recovering better at the moment than Vingegaard. You know, there's all these things that we don't know, but indicators that might be in favor of Almeida, but he still needs to bridge that gap, and he's not going to bridge 48 seconds on the time trial. But if he can just claw away a bit of time from that advantage that Vingegaard has, this Vuelta is still somewhat open, more open at least than we thought it would be.
Yeah, Brian, I'm just looking at their time trial results, the comparison. It's 4-3 to Almeida in 7 times they've ridden against each other. This goes back way back to 2018, Le Triptyque des Monts et Châteaux, which is a big under 23 race in 2018.
Wow. He was good back then, Vingegaard. I mean, he's always been a good time trialist, you know, in even in his younger days.
Well, indeed, just looking at those results, the worst either of them has ever finished in a time trial in which they've both competed is 13th. But the most sort of analogous stages that I can see, obviously in the Tour de France this year, stage 7, Vingegaard finished fourth. Almeida was eighth. The Vuelta last year, two years ago, stage 10, incidentally, in Valladolid, where the time trial is next week. 25.8 kilometers.
Quite similar.
Yeah, Almeida was fourth. Vingegaard was 10th. I'm just going to look at the time gap between them. It was about 20-30 seconds.
And Vingegaard was absolutely flying in that Vuelta.
It could be very close. And I just wonder whether Almeida himself is probably coming to the conclusion that it will be very difficult to achieve that separation on a mountain stage. But if they keep adding to the fatigue that Vingegaard has built up, and you know, I don't want to attach too much importance to something that Vingegaard said to me in an interview, but when I asked him about the period between the Tour and the Vuelta, he did talk about trying to hold on to as much of the Tour form as possible. Is it a case of UAE just hoping that sort of the last remnants of that form are eroded in the last week and his condition does sort of fall off the very high plateau that it's been on for a very long time now?
Certainly make an argument for UAE to keep putting that pressure on, you know, even on the stages that aren't obvious, you know, even stage 16, which is not, I mean, it finishes uphill, but it's not a big mountain stage per se, but it's lumpy all the way through the final even. They'll just have to keep that pressure mounting. They'll just have to keep pushing for that level of fatigue in Vingegaard. That would be the only tactic, and they certainly have the team to do that.
Yeah. Brian, also in the GC conversation, shall we say, another good day, and this is sort of backed up what we felt yesterday, that Jai Hindley is probably the third strongest rider in this race at the moment. And it was kind of a bold move from them. Obviously, they've got Pellizzari in the white jersey, and I think he's strong enough at the moment to sort of do two or three jobs, Pellizzari. So he was able to retain his advantage in the white jersey and also do that brilliant job that he did for Jai Hindley. And that was at the point on the climb where, so La Farapone is a very straight road, and it was really into the teeth of that headwind. But in the last 2 or 3 kilometres, it does start to hairpin, and the wind was probably less of a factor there. If there's one place you could have made a difference, it was there, and that's indeed what they tried to do.
It's useful for UAE that Hans Grohe now really wants to put, they want to get rid of Pidcock. That's perfect for UAE. And just one last thing on going in, so that there's a really hard mountain stage the day before the time trial, like a very hard mountain stage with a super steep finish. So there's a lot of relevant speculation, I think. It's certainly not over yet.
It would have been interesting to see what would have happened if Red Bull hadn't gone to the front at that point, because that was exactly the point when João Almeida was left alone. I think that was Groschartner was the last man, wasn't he? And he'd done his last pull. And just as Almeida was about to start sort of flapping about in the wind, then Red Bull came to the front and Almeida could follow wheels again. Brian, just one thing, I'm intrigued to get your thoughts on this, just a sort of maybe a trivial, maybe a sort of frivolous aside. The pull that Nico Denz did in the valley before La Farapona, I was watching that with some colleagues, and today there were a lot of satellite riders employed.
As we talked about yesterday.
Yeah, we hear a lot about this in professional cycling, and very seldom, I would say, maybe I'm misguided or naive in this, very seldom do they prove that useful, really particularly useful, but it's still something that is kind of mythologized in professional cycling. We talk about it all the time, send guys down the road. And Mikael Björk in that interview, he gave me a very good explanation as to why he would do that on a day like today, because otherwise he would have been pretty much useless in the second half of the stage. As it was, he was useful. However, Nico Denz doing his big sort of theatrical is a bit unkind, but his big pull in the valley before La Farapona, it struck me, Brian, that directors sportifs love to use their satellite rider coming back to do that big pull almost to vindicate the decision to send that guy down the road, even if he would be better served, I don't know, concentrating on making sure the team leader was well fed, well watered, and so on and so forth. But it's what almost always happens in that situation is the satellite rider coming back, gets sent to the front to do a huge pull, even if it doesn't make a whole lot of sense in the architecture of the race.
Specifically, that team has been very good at it also. You know, when when Jai Hindley won the Giro, it was partly, you know, you remember that stage where you and I were, was it up on the Marmolada? That was really a satellite rider that kind of made the big difference. Kemna really, that was a masterclass of satellite riding, really. Some team, I remember Bjarne Riis, he was a big fan of it. I mean, that I see what you mean with them vindicating the decision by just forcing them to do any kind of pull, and it could be a pull.
I always think the directors think it makes them look good.
But also, you don't have to rewind further back than the second to last stage of this year's Giro.
Oh, you know, obviously, yeah. Obviously, sometimes it definitely does pay off.
Sometimes it's a game changer, you know, and, you know, or, you know, the way that same Van Aert maneuver did it for when they really put the knife in on Vingegaard, on Pogacar the first time Vingegaard won over him. But it's that one rare occasion. And sometimes, I mean, today was kind of, you couldn't really see how that any of those riders would potentially be a threat to Vingegaard. This situation now with UAE, it's a bit of a Rorschach test when they send riders up the road, because you couldn't really tell, could you? Like, so it's almost, you'd have to guess really if it's for winning the stage or as a satellite rider.
Yeah, yeah. And I think they sort of hedged their bets. As we heard earlier, there's the option, they generally have the strongest guy in any break. So there's the option, if things pan out in the way that they hope, that the way they want, that they go for the stage win, and if it doesn't work out, then they've got the satellite rider waiting and ready.
That's the crux of it with the UAE, is that they just have such an abundance of strength that's only matched by their egos.
Yeah. Well, Brian, speaking of how one defeats UAE in a breakaway, or how one defeats UAE in any kind of stage, in any kind of circumstances in races, and particularly in this Vuelta a España, I did speak after the finish as well to two riders who failed in that endeavour, although they both rode very valiantly and very well today. I'm talking about the two British riders, Finley Pickering, young British rider who we spoke to a couple of days ago in Corrales de Huelna when he was in the break and came close that day. He came close again today. In fact, after Marc Soler, he was the best of the riders who had been in the breakaway. We're going to hear from him, and we're going to hear from the British rider as well who led the race over the San Lorenzo climb. I'm talking about EF Education Easy Posts, James Shaw.
Finley, you're one of the most active from the word go today. Tell me about the plan that was sort of sketched out in the bus this morning.
We wanted to go in the break, and I was saying, I want to go in the break. It's worth a try. Maybe everyone's a bit tired this week, so maybe they're a bit hesitant. I found myself alone. My thought was, it's better maybe to get up the road. They have to come to me, and then whoever jumps, I can maybe get on the wheel, because I was already riding my tempo, and they come to me riding a bit harder, so maybe it was easier for me to jump on the wheel. But yeah, luckily it worked, and then everyone started rolling through. Mikel Bjerg was fairly strong, and that helped keep the break away. Today I wasn't scared of the stage, because it suits me. The more elevation, the better. So yeah, I had a good go.
Just last thing, we didn't see the moment when Mark went away with Stauna Mitter at the bottom of the climb, and obviously the wind was a big factor on the final climb as well. Just tell us about the final climb.
A few AG2R boys, I don't know what they were doing with three guys. Yeah, three guys to chase one UAE guy in a headwind. So I don't know what happened there, and then, like, it's a hard stage, they rode pretty well, but with three riders you have options, and, you know, to let Mark go away is quite a
mistake.
Yeah, he's obviously a strong rider, and he's a smart guy. Chapeau to him, and chapeau to everyone in the break. I mean, we tried.
Well, James, that go down, it's a fun day out, is fun the right word?
tap two fun. Yeah, it's one of those things like, start the day, think it's a great idea. You get halfway around, you think, what am I doing? And then in 25 years' time, you look back and you'll be like, yeah, that was quite cool.
Telling someone stories. The important thing, was it your fun idea?
We sat on the bus this morning, we said, is the break going to the finish? Half of us said yeah and half of us said no. So we were flipping a coin and I saw that group going and I thought, wow, you know what, actually, that I do want to be in that. I was climbing really, real well. I gave it a nudge over the top, took the descent as fast as I dare. Took maybe 20 seconds. I just needed a guy or two to come with me. That group worked really well together. Obviously, sort of had a plan to try and build the road for Almeida. I don't know what happened in the end.
Soler won. If I told you that Soler, because on the top of San Lorenzo, just before you went, it looked as though he was struggling a little bit. If I told you he was the stage winner there, would you have been surprised?
I would when I saw him pull over. In hindsight, I wouldn't have gone on the top. I'd have waited and tried to sit on his wheel. You live and learn, don't you?
Obviously, the wind was a big factor today, certainly when we drove over these climbs earlier on. What was it like? So obviously on San Lorenzo, it was tailwind. Here, it was a headwind. I mean, how much do you think that affected the outcome of the race?
Oh yeah, obviously massively, you know, when you think a guy like Soler, he's going to get that tailwind, you know, it's going to be massively in his favour. Slightly frustrated with myself that, you know, I didn't have the foresight for that, but it's hard to predict. I'm still obviously still chasing a ride for next year at the minute, so I'm opening every door that's there and trying to jump through it. I'm happy with the performance, but obviously disappointing, and obviously if I could have read that wind better and read the conditions of the road a bit better, might have been different, but...
Hard to put yourself in the shop window when UAE win every stage.
Yeah, it isn't it? Like, the opportunity's there, isn't it? Like, I've got to go through the door. But yeah, you know, when they are, generally speaking, a league above everybody else, apart from maybe one or two other teams, the best guys win. You can't get annoyed by it, can you? You can only do what you can do and only control the elements you can control. So I'll wake up tomorrow, it's a new day, and have that rest day, and you'll either find me in the group out of saving my legs or off the front chasing whatever UAE jersey is also in that breakaway.
At time of recording, as far as we know, James Shaw and Finney Pickering both on the market for next year, which I'm quite surprised about in both cases, to be honest.
Do you think it's a case they haven't been announced, or?
No, I'm not sure about Pickering, whether something's happened in the last few days. James Shaw certainly is still on the market, and I think he's a little bit confused as to why EF Education have not offered him a deal currently. That might change, but I think he's a little bit confused.
Certainly made
by
a good
that.
Case for his signature today.
Yes,
that was a strong
yes.
Ride.
I'm sure he would be an asset to a lot of teams. Brian, it's time for today's Encuentro del Día. As we know, this week we're concentrating on riders who are riding their first Grand Tour, and it is the turn of Alpecin's Gal Glivar, who is a Slovenian rider, 23 years old, from Novo Mesto. His father was a Srećko Glivar, who was second in the 1993 Tour of Slovenia. Gal, his son, was at UAE's sort of academy team, next gen team, until this year, but he moved in the closed season, and what he's riding his first full professional season with Alpecin. He's already had a couple of top 10s in 2025 in tours of Norway and Switzerland. I spoke to him this morning in, where were we this morning, Brian? Where was it? Aviles. And he was sporting a sort of Jonas Vingegaard style, very blonde, slightly sort of tousled moustache. That's not mentioned in the interview. Anyway, here is Gal Glivar speaking to me this morning.
El encuentro del día, the meeting of the day.
So Gal, just how is it going generally?
Yeah, it's special. The fatigue we produce now in 2 weeks is just crazy, and it's hard to imagine how the GC guys are fighting, because yeah, I'm already super tired and it's a hard race, and yeah, I'm enjoying it still.
That was something that struck me the other day when Ayuso won. Everyone's talking about Ayuso's problems. The guy is so talented. I know how much the rest of you are suffering, and it seems like he just decides to win a stage and he wins it.
Ayuso is superstar of our sport, and it's still impressive how aggressive is he when he lost the GC. But yeah, it's impressive to see how he's still racing and how motivated he is.
Gal, I read a bit about your story. You did an interview with a colleague, Daniel Benson, where you talked about how you got into the sport. And your father was into the sport, wasn't he? And he used to take you to races.
he was a cyclist, but then he was a sport director in many teams. And how I came in the sport, it was like a normal way for me, because I went with him to the races, sitting in the car, meeting with the riders, and yeah, I just fell in love with it.
I believe that you were allowed to go to races as long as you were doing well at school, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. But I remember one fun story when it was Tour of Slovenia. It was like Wednesday or something. We have to pick up Matthew Goss in airport, and I skipped my school just to go to the airport to pick him up. So that's a nice memory I have.
Matt Goss, who was he riding for at the time?
Orica Greenedge.
Do you think, because obviously you were very young, watching these races, listening to people talk about professional cycling, or cycling, do you think you absorbed a lot of things that you still use today in your career?
Oh, discipline and hard work. When I was young, I was having fun just riding with friends, and yeah, I keep that in professionals now.
Well, for a couple of years, and I know this is you've had this question a lot, and it's kind of got on your nerves about Pogacar. You were the people look for the next young, the best sort of young Slovenian, 3 years, 4 years younger than Pogacar, and they just fell on your name. Can you remember the first time that someone suggested you might be the next Pogacar?
I don't remember really, but yeah, it's like in everything, when someone from your country is famous, then every next good rider is compared with. But I still think we are all different, and we have different stories, different, yeah, everything. But it's nice to be compared, but I don't really care much.
Well, you were in that team, UAE, you've joined Alpecin, which of course is not a GC team, but from what I can understand, you think this has been a good choice because you're going to have opportunities here.
Yeah, I can imagine it's so much relaxed because we don't care about the GC. Yeah, when it's hard day, we take it as easy as possible. When it's a good chance for a breakaway, we take it. And yeah, it's so much relaxed and it suits me well.
But you see yourself more now as a puncher more than someone who's going to become a GC rider, is that right?
Yeah, for sure. I won few overall victories last 2 years, but it's just different level compared with World Tour. But I'm enjoying breakaways and punchy terrains.
Last thing, Gal, just tell me, what's been your best moment of the Vuelta so far? The moment in a stage when you felt the best, and what's been the worst moment of your Vuelta so far?
Yeah, for sure my favorite was the stage one when we delivered victory with Jasper. That stage I won't forget.
What was your role that day?
Yeah, just to bring guys into good position into the final. Yeah, caring to stay cool during the race with all the cold water and all this stuff.
And then the worst moment so far? The moment where you've suffered the most and you wanted it just to end?
I think it was stage before the first rest day, when we were fighting for 2 hours for a breakaway, and I had really, really bad day. And I was suffering just staying on the wheel, but I managed to get through. But yeah, that was a hard moment.
La etapa de mañana, la cena de ayer. Tomorrow's stage, yesterday's food.
Well, Brian, yesterday's dinner, it was another arroz, another rice dish, a sort of paella dish with wild boar and hongos, which are a type of mushroom. I'm not sure, can't remember what they are in English, but yeah, it was okay, Brian, it was okay. Again, last night, I'm going to get the Spanish, the gastronomic hate police, hate squad coming at me, because...
But it's all due to the fact that you don't eat fish then.
Yes, exactly. So really I'm exonerate.
Sounds like there was you were in a nice environment at least.
Yes, Oviedo.
Being in Oviedo.
Yeah, Oviedo is a place I always enjoy spending time in. We go there pretty much every year. Pretty much all of the Vuelta spends at least one night or two nights in Oviedo. It's a kind of base camp for the Asturian stages. We were very close to the Angliru yesterday. We're a bit further away from La Farapona, and we're not staying there. We're not staying there tonight. Incidentally, in Oviedo, usually from my morning run,
I simply do laps. There's a nice park in the middle of Oviedo called San Francisco. But today, Brian, and I don't know why I'd never done this before, I headed for the Naranjo. The Naranjo. It's a legendary climb, a hill that rises above Oviedo, almost a mountain, and was very famous for a race called the Subida al Naranjo, which was a one-day race. I think actually it may have been a stage race at one point, but it was based around the Naranjo. And this is a sort of temple of Asturian cycling. This morning in my little Strava history lessons, I told the story of 1974 Vuelta stage up there, big duel between Fuente, José Manuel Fuente, El Tarangu, and Luis Ocaña. It was sort of the last act in their quite bitter duel for a couple of years. Ocaña had won the Tour the previous year in 1973. Fuente got revenge on the Naranjo. It was his sort of home climb. Well, he was an Asturian, so all of the support was really in his favour. Ocaña was literally getting dog's abuse because he grew up in France, and among the sort of insults that he said after the finish line he was getting that day was he was a French dog. Anyway, Fuente prevailed, and he prevailed in that Vuelta a España. But that was very beautiful this morning. We saw sort of Oviedo waking under a blanket of mists. We've had great weather over the last couple of days, which is unusual in Oviedo and in Asturias. But we're moving out of Asturias tomorrow into another very beautiful region of northern Spain, also not noted for its dry and sunny weather, but we are going to Galicia, Brian, and we've got a stage to a place called Monforte de Lemos. Your countryman, Magnus Cort, has won there, won a very similar stage there in the Vuelta a few years ago. But Brian, we've got a first category climb straight out of the gate.
It's a hard stage, Nathaniel.
Straight out of the gate, isn't it?
Yeah. It's 16.4 kilometers.
Yeah,
going straight out the gate.
5.1%. Brian, just at first glance, I mean, obviously, it's the kind of stage you would say immediately will break away, but may there be scope for something else tomorrow? Particularly yesterday, we talked about UAE, their strength in numbers. Could they attempt something? And if so, what? What would it look like?
I'm pretty sure that there will be attacks. Obviously, it will be a breakaway stage. But then it's just a question of the composition of the breakaway, because I am 100% convinced the UAE will be represented. I think it would be dangerous for Visma not having someone there. Then it's just a question of whom. It would be interesting if they do send, if they actually turn the tables and send someone like Jorgensen in there. I think it would be smart, because it would sort of keep a leash on how far the breakaway would go, and it would mean that they wouldn't have to work, and then other teams would have to realize that they would have to do part of the pulling on a stage like that. But it's sort of a Massif Central type of a stage. As we all know, the entire Spanish plateau is Massif Central, you know, it's all up at least above 400-500 meters. And tomorrow they're hovering in between 600 and 1,000 meters most of the day. But the bulk of the climbing tomorrow is in the first half, the first two thirds at least. And there's a tiny, some climbing at the end, and then it finishes downhill or flat. Very difficult stage to interpret, but I'm convinced it's going to be a breakaway. It's just a question of the size and the composition.
Brian, a name for tomorrow. I think Kwiatkowski, I haven't spoken to him for a few days. I don't know how he's going. Obviously, he started the Vuelta very well. He would be someone I would look out for tomorrow. I noticed that he came in quite a long way back today. I don't know whether he was sort of saving his bullets. But yeah, there were a lot of distinguished names who lost quite a lot of time today. David Gourdou proving that, well, 1 year you're the hammer, 1 year you're the nail. He came in a long way down, the last winner, of course, before today in La Vuelta a España on La Farapona.
Mikel Landa type, you know. I would say basically anyone, Ineos, who we haven't heard of for a while, they should be there again.
Ben Turner was, well, Egan Bernal was dropped before Ben Turner today, or Ben Turner was certainly assisting him on the San Lorenzo climb, so he's obviously still going climbing pretty well. So there's another name. Ineos certainly, well, they could certainly do with a stage win, but they could do with being at the forefront, at the front of the race.
Been a bit quiet also on the old Astana side. You know, I know that Tejada was there today, went up significantly in the GC, but in general, you know, maybe even could be, I don't know, Ciccone is suffering a bit, but he's out of the GC, could be a day for him as well.
Now we're just throwing around names, aren't we? Brian.
Well, that's what we do. That's what we do.
No more speculation.
That's what we do when we do.
No more speculation. On that note, Brian, I'm going to wish you a good evening, and we will reconvene tomorrow.
Absolutely. Cheers, Daniel.
Thank you, Brian.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Byrne.